For some 20 years during the last half of the second century of this Compton era, Marcus Aurelius ruled as emperor in Rome. This emperor was a man of unusual talent. He was a capable administrator and he was wholly at home in all academic and philosophic pursuits. I had occasion recently to reacquaint myself with some of his meditations. As always, when I browse through his literary output, I am amazed at its aptness of thought and its relevance to modern life. But on this particular rereading, I was struck by a singular, archaic, and outdated observation. He wrote in this vein, "Our children will see nothing that we have not seen, as we do not see anything unknown to our fathers." I know a few observations from our forefathers which highlight in a more dramatic fashion the discontinuity of human experience between all pre-modern men and our own age. The path of progress in ancient times was languid and it was sluggish. Man could not shake himself of certain ever-present, ever-threatening shadows which accompanied his every step and overwhelmed his life with fear and with threat. But man could not shake his dependence upon nature. Man lived near unto death. Man feared the flood and the drought, the blight and the pestilence, the plague and disease. Man feared mass poverty and mass illiteracy, and he had no vision of a world without these evils, or in which these evils were largely mitigated and erased. To ask an ancient, "Is there anything of which it can be said, see, it is new?" was generally to receive an unhesitating answer, "No, there is nothing of which it can be said, see, this is new. It has already been in the generations that were before. That which has been is that which shall be. That which has been done is that which shall be done. There is nothing new under the sun." But listen now to a modern voice. Modern social historian commenting on life today. Here is his view. "The only essential experience which we share in common with our pre-scientific ancestors is the common bond of our mortality. The only life experience which we share in common with our pre-modern ancestors is our common mortality." Now, this is to overstate the case, but it is also to emphasize what we sometimes forget, that there is a radical discontinuity between the human experience, that our life is radically different in its social environment than was the life of those who lived more than two generations ago. For whether a man lived 4 millennia before the Common Era, or 400 years ago, his life was lived out on a level, terrestrial, earthbound plane. He was subject to the whims of nature, whims over which he had no control and against which he had few defenses. He was subject to the periodic incursions of plague and disease which destroyed whole communities and whole cities. Childbirth was a matter of grave danger. Childhood was the age of death. Man lived amidst fear, and man could not see that his fellow men had radically improved civilization, had radically changed man's social environment. And so they looked upon life as an eternal cycle of birth and rebirth, a wheel spinning free of the ground, which though it spun at a great speed, moved nowhere. The ancients believed that man had been cursed by the punishment of Adam. Man was doomed to everlasting back-breaking, spirit-breaking toil, and there was to be no relief, there could be no relief from this toil. For man had no tool save a single mind and two hands. And no philosopher or thinker of the ancient world could see how with this one mind and two hands, man could ever produce an abundance of food or a sufficiency of goods for himself and his family and his community and his world. Today we have created great labor-saving machines. Today we have a serious social problem of leisure and its constructive use. How radically our life has changed. We know that man need no longer be subjected to a life of unrelieved toil and labor. The ancients believed that there was no relief from the curse of poverty. The New Testament says that the poor shall always be among us, and this was generally believed throughout the ancient world. But they could not conceive that man would ever be able to create a sufficiency of the good things, of the material things of the world, to provide for all men. We are plagued with the fear of overproductivity. We know that the poor need no longer always be among us. We have, at least in the Western world, created a society which has mitigated the worst of the curse of poverty and has shown that mankind can live a world of sufficiency and in a world of plenty. The ancients lived close to death. They were cursed by diseases for which they had no cure. They were cursed by plagues against which they had no immunization. They were cursed by an abbreviated lifespan which destroyed the potential of so many before it had begun to be realized. We have immunized whole communities, whole continents. We have found cures for diseases always heretofore fatal. We have made childhood not the age of death, but the age of health. We are faced today not with a problem of death, but really with a problem of old age, as a society is having to adjust itself to an increased number of elderly people and is having to develop institutions of social service and of health to meet and to cope with their problems. The ancients, seeing life in its bleaker colors, were wont to cultivate a philosophy of pessimism. Marcus Aurelius was a Stoic. He believed in resignation. He believed in the fact that the world could not be radically improved and therefore man should not radically commit himself to programs of world and social improvement. Faced with the success multiplied by success of our scientific age, we ought to be buoyant and optimistic, filled with hope. And yet, strangely, our philosophies accent and highlight the theme of despair, of resignation, and of fatalism, even more than that of Marcus Aurelius. Think of those who have looked into the crystal ball of the future. Think of George Orwell's 1984. Think of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World Revisited. Think of T.S. Eliot's Wastelands. Nightmare visions painted with nightmare colors upon a nightmare canvas. Is it that these men discount the actuality of our scientific advance? No, this is not so. Many of these men are scientists themselves, and they know full well how far man has ascended up the ladder of progress. Why then their despair? Why then their fear? Why then their vote of no confidence in our future? They have no confidence in our future because they have no confidence in us. They have no confidence in our future because though they admit freely the victories and the achievements of the mental man, they are not at all hopeful or confident of the potentialities of the moral man. True, we have had great discoveries. We have made amazing inventions. We have created tools and machines which can think for us and produce for us. But we have not yet proven in the scheme of world history that we are capable of turning these machines not to the good of a few, but to the good of all. We have not yet shown that we are sufficiently morally aware or morally sensitive or morally determined to avoid programs of lust and of greed, to develop policies of common good and for the common weal. These historians, these prophets of the future, look upon the history of man and they see it with jaundiced eyes. They say that man has never been able to control his greed. That man has always been concerned primarily with material acquisition and not with moral commitment. They say we are mentally mature but morally adolescent. They say that we will be incapable, unable to control the very achievements, the very inventions, the very machines, the very discoveries which make for the blessing we have brought to our age and the potential blessing which we might bring to all ages yet to come. I speak to you this morning out of a profound conviction that we face an age of grave crisis. I do not look as despairingly as do these prophets upon human psychology. I fear that they prejudge us. I fear that they discount too radically the achievement of great groups of men in raising us from animals living in the jungle to social animals living in a highly cultured and civilized world. I feel that the future is fraught with great promise, but I and you surely agree that it is fraught also with great peril. And it is to a discussion of some of these perils that I would turn your attention here and now. Each of our achievements points to hope, and it points also to danger. Think of our machines, our automated factories, our ability to produce an avalanche, a torrent of goods that can go into every home and equip every element, every individual in our society with all types of pleasure and beauty. Think of these machines. Think of the factories which are being automated. Think of the men who have been freed from hours of routine, uninspired labor. But think also of the hundreds who have no more machines at which to labor. Think of the hundreds whose jobs have been displaced, taken away by machines created by other men. Think of the office. Think of the file clerks who have been displaced by small memory tubes which can do the jobs of 100 men. Think of the accountants who have been displaced by thinking machines who can, with less error and greater speed, do the job of hundreds upon hundreds of individuals. Think of the office secretary typists, soon to be outdated, rendered extinct by typescribers of electronic capacity. Think of the problem of social reorganization, of technological unemployment with which our automotive machines face modern man. Now, the economists tell us that technological unemployment is generally only a temporary social phenomenon, that every new machine creates new jobs. It must be manufactured, it must be serviced, it must be watched. But I am concerned with this period of interregnum, this period in between, The in-between period before our society has adjusted itself to production in a scientific age. I am concerned because I know that however temporary a large pool of unemployed may be, it is in their bitterness, it is in their resentment that fascism is bred. And it is to such people that the demagogues and rabble-rousers of every age have always appealed and from which they've always drawn their support. I am concerned because though we know that we will have these pools of reservoirs of the unemployed, we seem not to be developing the institutions of support, of financial support, of education, of job re-education and technical re-education, which will foreshorten this period and which will make it possible for those who are no longer employed to be employable once again. I am concerned because our society seems to be saying, we will automate now and we will think of the results of automation later. And that is a philosophy of folly. If we are concerned with human values and with social values, then certainly we cannot be unconcerned with those who will have no living. We cannot be unconcerned with the happiness of those who will lack the skills. We cannot be unconcerned for the fate of our free society faced with the tensions of angry men led and misled by political adventurers. I'm concerned also by a challenge which is placed before us not by our machines, but by our new electronic media of communication. 400 years ago, there were less books in our whole world than there are in our main public library here in Cleveland today. 40 years ago, it required days and sometimes weeks for news to pass from one part of our world to another. 14 years ago, it was still impossible to pass across the air anything except the spoken word. Today, we can bring sight and sound into our homes. And soon all the senses will be excited by the images which will be brought through our television and other electronic sets. Now this has brought great boon to man, as has the automated machines brought great boon to mankind. It has made it possible for us to be more fully aware of all the political ramifications of life in our day. It has brought into our homes the best of the culture of our day. It has given us relief and entertainment. But I am concerned by this, that these electronic media of mass communication are equally adept at bringing entertainment and education and propaganda and government-directed publicity. The big truth and the big lie equally easily pass across the empty airspace. I am concerned that as we watch and are entertained, we must be aware of the dangers of censorship and government manipulation and control of these mass media. Goebbels taught the world how this can be done. Radio Moscow and Radio Cairo and Radio Free Europe are agents of governmental, under governmental direction. In a dictatorship, these government radios are not turned only against one's potential enemies or towards people without one's border, but they are turned in on one's own citizenry. And by a careful choice of ideas through censorship, they brainwash that citizenry into agreement with the policies of the government then in power. And never before have governments had similarly useful media with which to convince the citizenry of their particular views and outlooks. Never before has as large a power over our minds been in the hands of those who control and distribute the news and the opinion and the entertainment which passes across the airspace. And I am concerned also by a second threat which our electronic mass communication systems present to us. And this is a threat perhaps even more dangerous than the first. Against the first, we can shut our eyes. Against propaganda, you can turn off the radio or the television. But this propaganda passes into our minds unawares. It passes at the level of the unconscious. They can throw onto a television or movie screen today images at such micro-instantaneous speeds that our eyes do not see it, but our minds understand it. They can convince us of certain needs and motivate us to certain actions in a way, in a manner of propaganda against which there is no conscious defense. And the use of such powers of subliminal suggestion, abused and misused by tyrants and by dictators, would permit them to blanket the world with agreement, to develop a form of propaganda more subtle and more devilish and more fiendish and more dangerous than any yet to be devised. To be entertained now and to worry about the controls of the freedoms of the dissemination of information later, this too is for our age the path of folly. The third of the problems which I should like to present to you today comes to us from a perhaps unexpected field. It comes to us because of the great strides and advances which have been made in the art of healing. Now again, none of us would undo these discoveries. They have brought too much of renewed health, too much of unexpected happiness to the human world. But all of us must be aware that where there were 1 billion people on the face of the globe in 1900 and 1900, there are 2,600,000,000 people on the face of our globe today, and there will be 10 billion people on the face of our globe in 2059. All of us must be aware that there are nations in Asia today which are starving because of overpopulation. All of us must be aware that in these nations, understanding citizens are beginning to talk of government-enforced birth control, government-enforced control of the powers of reproduction, of human reproduction, because else they feel the society will be condemned to submarginal existence, to misery and to internal ruin. For governments to gain, because of the pressures of population, the power of birth control is to place in the hands of government one of the most essential freedoms known to man. It was the power over the birth of a minority which Pharaoh in ancient Egypt coveted. It is the power to destroy minority groups, unwanted groups, if abused and misused. Now the problem our world faces is not one essentially of overpopulation. It is one which perhaps can best be illustrated by a single statistic. 70% of the food production of our world is grown in countries which represent 16% of our world's population. The problem which faces our world is one of unequal distribution of the Earth's abundance. The problem which faces the nations of plenty is the development of a sensitivity to the needs of other peoples, the development of a willingness to give of what they have, to share not only their produce, but their knowledge to the underdeveloped nations. For if we do not, not only will these nations be faced with economic ruin, but the people of these nations will turn to demagogues who will promise them the world, and they will march off to conquer the world, and they will bring our world into ruin. For our world cannot tolerate decade upon decade of misery bred unrest. And unless Americans learn to spend more of what they themselves have for the good of all men, regardless of their national denomination, of their country's label, we are going to plunge our world precisely into generations-long unrest. We Americans have spent in the years since the end of the Second World War a great deal of money on Point 4 programs and other programs for the development of these nations. But perhaps it may shock you to know that in no one year have we spent more on such programs of economic rehabilitation than we have in developing for ourselves and decorating our own tombstones. This is the need. The need to live with a heart filled with compassion, with a mind willing to sacrifice something of our superabundance, that those who are sunk so deep in need may not die of malnutrition, that countries may not die of economic plight, and that their countries adventuring and pirating throughout the world, as did Japan, for the same reasons before the Second World War, that these countries may not plunge the world into an atomic holocaust. The fourth and last of the challenges which face modern man is the one which needs least to be spoken about, but is most imminent, most potentially catastrophic. We are presented with a problem because of our new machines and our new mass media and our new medicine. We are equally, and even to a larger extent, presented with a problem because of our new means of power. Now, we needed these new means of power. The fossil fuel on which our Earth has moved its machines and developed its economy will in a century or so be exhausted. But fission and fusion can not only turn the wheels of industry and bring light to our cities, but they can lighten the funeral pyres of humanity and burn and lighten the world with the fires of hell. Will there be war? Will there be peace? This is the crucial question facing us. Can we claim now, be indifferent to these questions, worry later? There may be no later time. There is little time, precious little time, for our world to find again its sanity, for our world to recognize that you cannot build peace simply by building greater and more ferocious implements of war, that you cannot build peace even by simply testing these implements of war, for the test itself brings disease into our world and possible death to generations yet unborn. How will we find this peace? This no one knows. But this certainly is true, that unless all the nations of the world learn to sacrifice and learn to compromise, unless all the citizens of our world know that they must spend really more time concerned with problems of foreign relations of peace than they do with building their own vocations and their own professions. For of what use is a profession in a world atomized? Of what use are the nest egg we have built for our children in a world in which our children will not be able to breathe or to live? This is our challenge, the crucial challenge which faces us. To build now, intelligently, competently, courageously, humbly, the institutions of world organization, the programs of world cooperation, which in themselves are the seed of a world at peace. The ancients described the dangerous passage through the Strait of Messina, which lies between Sicily and Italy, in these ways. They knew that many of the ships which passed through these perilous waters broke up on its reefs. And so they said that on the Italian shore there was a great sucking whirlpool which drew into its maw any ship which drew too near. And on the Sicilian shore, there were dangerous rocky reefs. And sitting on these reefs were 100 lovely, beautiful sirens who sang out to the mariners and enticed them to draw close to the shore, knowing that their ships would break up on the rocks. Now, we must also past the ship of our civilization through a narrow strait. To our left are the unpredictable wills and whims of tyrants and demagogues and dictators. Over these we have really no control. About these we can only pray that they will be less than we fear, less dangerous to man. To the right there are a thousand sirens singing to us a song of which we must beware, a song which, if we abide and listen to, will bring us to our destruction. The song is one of indifference. The song is one not to worry. The song says to us, live now, think later. Build your machines now. Worry about economic dislocation when you're faced with the fact. Entertain yourselves now through your television. Worry about the controls of its freedoms later. Enjoy the long life promised you by your medicine, the health which it has given you now. Worry about the dangers of overpopulation and malnutrition later. Live your life of peace and of plenty now. Worry later about the dangers of war, when that danger is really there. The danger is there, and the time is now. The opportunity may not come again. For what a world for our children. We have in our hands two choices. Choices which the Bible presented to us in the portion I read to you this morning, life and death. No generation has been faced more dramatically with this choice. There is death in our hands, death for human civilization if we choose the wrong way, if we are indifferent, if we are morally insensitive, if we lack moral courage. But there is also the way of life. A fuller, finer, more prosperous, more plentiful, healthier life than men have ever known, for us and for our children. If we prove not unworthy, incapable, morally adolescent as we face the crises of today. Amen.